on the shoreline of what was the ancient name, which was Canaan, and had and they fought wars against the Jews. Whether they got there before the Jews or not, who knows? But the point is that they were the ancient enemies of Israel under the kings. So Hadrian, feeling that by defeating Bar Kokhba, he had ended Judaism and he had ended the Jewish people as such, he renamed it Palestina. The Romans didn't see Judaism, as it were, as a religion. They saw it as a nationality, as a people, as a nation state, and it was one that they claimed no longer existed because of its defeat in the Bar Kokhba rebellion. He also renamed Jerusalem Aliyah Capitolina, and he put an idol, a statue of Zeus, on top of the temple at the Temple Mount. The temple had already been destroyed by the Roman forces of Titus about maybe 50 years before that. This was one final rebellion. So thus you had Palestina became the name of the Roman province that would be part of Syria, and that would be named as such because there was this claim that the Jews no longer existed. Well, of course, the Jewish community of what then became known as Palestina continued to exist and had various ups and downs over the next several hundred years, several centuries, first under the Romans and then under the Byzantines. They actually created a Talmud. It's called the Palestine Talmud. They adapted the name Palestine for their country. In the maybe about 25 years before the Muslim conquest, which occurred in the 8th century, the 7th century, I believe, there was a brief period of independence against the Byzantines when the Jewish community, centered around Tiberias at the time, rebelled against the Byzantines with the support of the Byzantines' main rival in the region, that being the Sassanians, who were, of course, from Persia. They actually achieved independence, which lasted maybe 20, 25 years. Eventually, the Byzantines were able to reconquer the region, suppress it brutally, I'll point out. And then about 15, 20 years after that, came the Muslim conquest. And the Muslims, who, after winning the Battle of the Yarmouk Valley under the leadership of Abu Bakr, who was the main successor to Muhammad, they were welcomed by the Jews with open arms. The third caliph, Ali, actually reestablished Jewish, not sovereignty, but Jewish rights in Palestine, allowed the Jews for the first time since the Byzantine era to re-enter and live in Jerusalem, and built a synagogue for the Jews. And that synagogue, according to many archaeologists, actually is the Dome of the Rock, because the Dome of the Rock is unlike any mosque, and it has writings and letters on it that indicate that it was, in fact, a synagogue for the Jews, and that this region was established as a Jewish neighborhood and remained a Jewish neighborhood throughout antiquity and right up until today. So that's a brief history of the term Palestine, which was resurrected by the British formally in 1920 when they established the Palestine Mandate. And you might even say that the original Palestine Mandate consisted of both banks of the Jordan. It was Cisjordan and Transjordan. Transjordan today is the Kingdom of Jordan, and Cisjordan today is the state of Israel. So it has been argued by some that actually Palestine is Jordan. In fact, one of the founders of the PLO in 1969, 1970, his name escapes me right now, actually referred to Jordan as Palestine and Palestine as Jordan, and the people of Jordan as completely indistinguishable from the people of the other side of the Jordan River, the Palestinian Arabs on the East Bank and on the West Bank. So, you know, one could argue and do so with legitimate historic precedents that there are actually already two Palestines, Jordan and Israel. All right, so that's the etymology part of the argument. The reality part is that under the Obama administration, there have been direct attempts to interfere in the politics of Israel, and specifically in the government of Benjamin Netanyahu. We know that in the last election in Israel, the Obama administration directly aided the Labor Party with the hope that they would take over from Netanyahu. In other words, they meddled directly in the politics and in the election of a foreign country, very much what Obama and some of his immediate associates are accusing Russia of doing here, which, by the way, there's no proof that they did, but putting that aside. The fact is that money poured in, and George Soros, who's an evil man and whose name often pops up in various settings whenever you have mischief of this kind anywhere in the world, where you've got people, organizations, or individuals who are trying to overthrow the existing order, if you will, and move their nations in the direction of what Soros calls a, quote, open society, what in fact is a socialist society. Soros was involved with financing the opposition to Netanyahu, that Israeli Arabs were brought into Washington literally to train as so-called community organizers, very much what Obama was before he became president, and to go out and try to get Herzog, who was Netanyahu's opponent, elected through American political means, like knocking on doors and raising money and whatnot. And that failed. In a sense, Israel reasserted its sovereignty by electing Netanyahu with an even larger majority. Excuse me. And thus you had interference by the Obama administration in Israel's internal affairs. The pressure brought to bear was to try to forbid Jews from living in Judea and Samaria, to try to prevent Jewish families from expanding their family, even from adding units to their houses, to sort of try to ban communities from expanding, and with the ultimate idea that these communities would be evacuated and the region would be stripped of Jews, so that a third, if you will, Palestinian state could be created, that this was somehow an idea that would develop into someone's strange idea of peace. I don't think any sane person would think that that would be peaceful. I think that it's something that, whether conscious or not, would be an attempt to dismantle and ultimately destroy the state of Israel. If you take a look at the map, I think you might agree, if you see the demographics involved here. Now, the resolution before the United Nations is the kind of anti-Israel resolution that has been brought up at the UN consistently in various forms, probably since the late 1960s, when an anti-Israel fever began to grip the United Nations. Let's not forget that originally the United Nations supported Israel. Charles Krauthammer, the columnist, in fact, documents very nicely a column that he just published, which shows that the United Nations has become obsessed with destroying Israel in the past maybe several decades, that every agency of the United Nations is focused on destroying Israel, criticizing Israel. He gives the example of the International Health Organization, which is a branch of the United Nations. Their main focus, their main public utterances and releases focuses on how Israel is cruel to Palestinian Arabs, which, by the way, is really not true. But putting that aside for the sake of argument, the fact that they would put such focus on that when you have countries in the world, in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, and elsewhere, that are really suffering major health crises, is a perfect example of how utterly deranged and biased the United Nations has become. And so these resolutions would be passed, and the United States, traditionally acting as Israel's friend, would veto the resolutions in the Security Council, and that would be that. Well, apparently, Barack Obama, who we now know did not veto the resolution that came up last week, but abstained and thus allowed it to pass, that the Israelis are now accusing Obama not only of abstaining with regard to this resolution, but actively promoting it behind the scenes, actively pressuring nations to pass it, trying to actually involved in the crafting of the resolution, which bans Jews from Judea, Samaria, and East Jerusalem, which calls for the dismantling of Jewish cities and towns in those regions as a prelude to a redrawing of the borders to create a third Palestinian state. And just as a sidebar to this, we may note that the original country that was supposed to present the resolution was going to be Egypt. The Israelis contacted the nascent transition team of President-elect Donald J. Trump, and they asked for help. They asked if Trump would simply come out publicly and let it be known that he was not a supporter of this resolution. That's all. Just make a statement saying that he does not support it and that he would be against it as president of the United States, which Trump immediately did. Now, once that happened, the Egyptian president, el-Sisi, decided that it was more important for him, as the leader of his country, to develop a friendly relationship with the new administration than it would be to buckle under and do the bidding of an administration that literally has only days left before it finally leaves. And so, as such, el-Sisi declined to submit the resolution. And that, in a way, is an example of how already influential Donald Trump is on the world stage. I mean, we know that he's already had very positive influence on the American economy. We already have several major corporations. Today, it was just announced that Sprint would be bringing back 5,000 jobs from overseas. We've seen Carrier agree not to shut down its plant in Indiana. We've seen other examples. And also, in general, the stock market is up, at least as of today, because there is a sense that the new administration is going to be more pro-America, more pro-business. It's going to get rid of onerous regulation. It's going to hold the line on taxes, if not lower them. And this creates a better business atmosphere, which means that businesses may expand, new jobs will be created, new revenue actually will come into the government because there'll be more revenue to tax. which is a much better way of the government raising revenue than just simply raising taxes on existing businesses, a very regressive idea. And there's a general feeling of confidence and exuberance, if you will, in the economy, thanks to Trump. Well, this is an example of where Trump's already had a positive influence on the world stage. But what happened, and this is now known historically, is that Barack Obama and his sinister team of insiders were able to effect an end run around Trump and Egypt by getting four nations to submit this terrible anti-Israel bill. And those are Senegal, New Zealand, I don't exactly remember, Venezuela, and there's a fourth one. All right. So the bill has now been passed through. The United States did not abstain. And Israel is now being knuckled by the United Nations, which is its implacable foe. In addition, it's now there's now a meeting scheduled in Paris in the next week or two by an international body affiliated with the United Nations that is going to seek to further strengthen this resolution and maybe even slap sanctions on the state of Israel. You've got all the BDS people, you know, absolutely, you know, dancing in the streets, probably passing out candy. And that there is concern that this organization may create and emanate another anti-Israel bill before the United Nations, which may be voted upon before Obama leaves office, and that Obama, once again, will abstain, will have the United States abstain, and this will mean that, again, Israel will be further slashed by this outgoing and repudiated administration. The whole spectacle of a president in a lame duck leaving office, especially given that the other party has won and that they will be assuming power very soon, that they would be involved in anything like this is disgraceful. It's wrong. It is technically constitutional, but it's certainly undemocratic. And that, you know, even though the days are dwindling away, we face some very dangerous and perilous couple of weeks. I mean, this weekend is New Year's. After that, Obama has maybe about two and a half weeks in office. Who knows what he might do? You know, we've already seen that he's increased the regulatory state. He's already committed, I think it's something like $75 billion more in spending to support executive orders. I mean, this is, he's releasing convicted felons who have been involved in violent crime through the presidential pardon and commuting sentences and reducing sentences. You know, it's not so easy in our system of justice, nor should it be easy, to get a conviction and to get someone off the streets. And to have Obama use the executive pardon power to simply erase that is a disgrace. It's not as bad as Bill Clinton, who actually used the pardon power to enrich himself and to get money donated to his library and to give a pass to his own brother and to Hillary Clinton's two brothers and other family members who were involved with crimes. He used it for personal gain. It was just pure unadulterated corruption, which, of course, is the legacy of the Clintons, in my opinion. And, of course, Bill Clinton also, by the way, he was issuing pardons right up to the very last day in office. In fact, that morning that he was to go to the swearing-in on January 20th, 2001, he was issuing pardons that morning. And when George Bush, after being sworn in, arrived in the Oval Office, he found pardons still piled up on Bill Clinton's desk that had not yet been sent out or signed. I mean, so talk about, you know, abusing a constitutional power. But in the case of Obama, these pardons are more ideological than they are personal. And as such, perhaps they're even more dangerous. But for him to be stepping out on the international stage and kicking Israel in the, you know, in the proverbials just before he leaves office should tell us everything we need to know about Obama, frankly, and about the people that surround him, his ilk. Their obvious hatred of the state of Israel, their attempt openly and brazenly to undermine the state of Israel. John Kerry's delivery of that speech yesterday with that phony British accent talking about, you know, Israel could either be democratic or Jewish, but not both. What the hell did he mean by that? This is more a systemic question than may meet the eye at first glance. It is a hatred of Israel because of two reasons, and it's the same two reasons that are why the left hates Israel. The first reason is because Israel actually is a relatively democratic state with a capitalist system, and a system that has become more capitalist in the administration of Benjamin Netanyahu. They respect the institutions of freedom, the right of the individual, private ownership of the means of production, property, the right to pursue happiness, the, you know, life and liberty. All of the ideals and principles that have made America great. Israel has embraced those to a high degree, not as high a degree as America, but Israel's not America. Israel is its own identity. And secondly, their hatred for faith, their hatred for religion that believes in God, in a spiritual side of existence, in the fact that a creator of the universe that is not part of nature, that is supernatural, that exists outside of man, that is beyond, in a sense, the ability of man to manipulate, that this God created the universe, created mankind in his image, and gave the laws, was the lawgiver, you know, gave the Torah to all of mankind through the children of Israel. This is what Judaism is, and they despise that because they want to replace God and God's immutable laws with man's, with socialism. This is they have this incredibly moral and superior attitude about their rights as so-called enlightened people to recreate man, to recreate the world, to establish an earthly paradise, a utopia. And so they hate Judaism. And by extension, they hate Christianity. They probably even hate Islam to a certain extent, to the extent that Islam, but Islam is a hybrid. I mean, I think Islam is both a religion, but it's also a political system that mirrors the communist idea. World control, utopian control of the planet under one rule, which is, by the way, the state of Israel as its own entity. Whether or not the people of Israel agree, the state, the very existence of the state of Israel rejects that principle and accepts and manifests the idea of the sovereign nation state in control of its own life, its own culture, its own religion, its own language, its own destiny, and operating in the interests of its own people in their quest to preserve and protect and defend those institutions. They hate that because Obama and his friends are interested in world socialism. They're interested in world order, ultimately. That's why they have engaged in policies over the past 8 years that have deliberately weakened our culture, have deliberately dumbed us down. They advocate schools and education system that dumbs down our children with the Common Core curriculum, with look-say reading so that they're semi-illiterate, with the stripping away of lessons about how the Constitution works, lessons about American culture, replacing them with a lot of gobbledygook about the world order. And the idea that, you know, that they're all a bunch of psychiatric cases, right? They have dumbed down our business community and our ability to be sovereign individuals economically with onerous taxes and with onerous regulation against business, all done with very vague and totalitarian language that can be twisted and turned by those in power. They have weakened our dollar. They have weakened our ownership of property. They have weakened our culture with their assaults and with their pushing the envelope in Hollywood. They have weakened our language, and they have weakened the American ethos with an increase in immigrants who don't share our values. I'm sorry to have to put it so bluntly, but the fact of the matter is that that Muslims do not share our values. That doesn't mean that they may not come to share our values. I hope and pray that they do. And I support their right to be Muslims in that context, just like Christians and Jews were able to do this. But lessons have indicated that that's not so easy, and that there is a strain within the Muslim community. This is one that has been identified by Harvard professor Alan Dershowitz, I'll point out, where it's not even an unwillingness to assimilate. And when I say assimilate, I don't mean lose your identity. But there is an insistence that the host country conform to who they are rather than the other way around. In other words, they're not loyal, and they're not you know, willing to play ball in the host country that takes them in, that protects them, and that gives them rights. Now, again, I realize I'm generalizing, and I have had on my program in the past Dr. Zudi Jasser, who is a very, very progressive Muslim leader in the true sense, who is very pro-American, and who actually warns us about the Sharia and jihadist element that exists within the Islamic community and what that is. Barack Obama has furthered that. And so it shouldn't surprise anyone that he is using the last drop of his tenure to stab Israel, to try to undermine the state of Israel, because Israel represents both of those ideals. You know, democracy in the form of capitalism and freedom, and faith in the form of Judaism, which by extension means faithful religious Christianity. And so Israel is at the front line. It's the canary in the mineshaft in terms of an outpost of freedom in the world. And by basically trying to stab it and trying to stifle it, Obama and his buddies are showing their true colors. Anyway, this is Chuck Morse. You're welcome to join me. I'm live right here at WMFO, 91.5 Medford, Boston, Tufts University, bringing an alternative voice to the Tufts community. Come on down, 855-915-9636, 855-915-9636. What is on your mind this afternoon? Let me see if I can do an electronic, a public service message.
I'm Theft Orchestra, and you're listening to WMFO.
This is a test to find out if you know it all when it comes to children. Name one of the leading killers of U.S. children age 1 to 13. What's the best way to protect children in a car crash? At what age and size should a child start using a booster seat?
Don't assume you know it all when it comes to car seats for your child. Go to safercar.gov/the right seat and know for sure. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
And we're back. Sorry about the little bit of overlap there. Again, I'm experimenting with the mixing board here. You're welcome to join the program. Chuck Morse here at WMFO 91.5 AM at Tufts University. 855-915-9636 is the number. 855-915-9636. So that is my analysis of this feckless, traitorous attack by the Obama administration on the state of Israel in their final days. It's not going to work. Israel is not going to in any way alter or change their trajectory because of Obama, or certainly not, or because of the United Nations. The Trump administration has made clear that they are going to stand strongly with the state of Israel. They have included in their ranks David Friedman, who is he's been around for a while. He's a solid conservative Jewish activist and Israel supporter. He has made reference to moving the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And I think that only Donald Trump would have the nerve to do that. This was a mistake that was made back in the Truman administration when you had anti-Semites in the State Department refuse to recognize Israel, refuse to recognize Jerusalem for entirely religious reasons. You have David Friedman rejecting the two-state solution. All right. So that brings us to that very topic. What about the two-state solution, so-called? Look, I'm here to express my opinion as a radio talk show host with an outreach to the Tufts University community. And in that capacity, I am going to state that opinion unequivocally. And that opinion is that the so-called two-state solution is dead, if it ever really had a chance to exist. There is not going to be another Palestinian state. There should not be another Palestinian state. John Kerry spoke about dismantling Jewish cities and towns in a region that he hopes to create another Palestinian state. That's not going to happen. The facts on the ground, as the Israelis like to put it, indicate that there are now, I think, approximately 350 to 400,000 Jewish families living in the area that is on the other side of what's called the Green Line in Israel. Those are the armistice lines that carved out Judea and Samaria in 1949 when Israel signed an agreement with, or a ceasefire agreement with, the King of Jordan. By the way, back then the region was called West Jordan, not the West Bank. The Palestinian Arab population of that region is dropping. Palestinian Arabs are leaving the region. The Israeli Jewish population is growing. In fact, the Israeli Jewish population in that region is one of the fastest growing populations in the world. And it's a combination of religious people who believe in God's mandate and command at Sinai for the Jewish people, the children of Israel, to take possession of that tiny swath of land that exists between the Jordan River and the Great Sea, the Mediterranean, as a birthright land and as a land that by doing so they would elevate themselves spiritually and serve as a light unto the nations, as a sort of a priestly class, a caste, that would set an example for the entire world and inspire the entire world with their higher level of ethics and faith toward eventually the coming of a miraculous event, a messianic event, which, of course, how that happens, how that's defined, the nature of that is something that, frankly, is beyond and should be beyond human comprehension. That is a matter that that resides only in the mind and the will of the creator of the universe, the Lord our God, blessed be he. We can only hope that that it happens, and we can hope that we take the necessary steps personally and politically to ensure that it does happen. Personally, that means being a better person, standing up for the right, being involved in politics, not withdrawing. I think some Christian fundamentalists make the mistake. They've been fooled into thinking that they just have to withdraw from politics with the hope that this just somehow happens. You have to be involved in politics. You have to stand up and identify good and evil and stand up for the good. And by doing so, you have a positive rippling effect in the world. On the political side, it is the fulfillment of a very modest and appropriate mandate that the children of Israel take possession of that tiny, inscrutable little piece of land that exists between the Jordan River and the Great Sea, which exactly is the borders of Israel today. Israel today exists within that region and nowhere else. It says from the north, from Dan to the north, to Beersheba to the south. Well, Israel today controls the Dan in the north. It's called a tell. It's an archaeological site near Metula, which is in the very northern tip of Israel's panhandle. And Beersheba in the south is one of the world's oldest contiguously occupied cities. It exists as a modern city, and its ancient city is right there as well. Israel is, that is the southern part of Israel. The only part of the state of Israel today that actually is not part of the mandate that God showed Abraham is the stretch of desert that goes from south from Beersheba down to the Gulf of Elad. It's called the Negev, which is the Israeli word for desert. It's just basically an empty piece of land. Other than that, Israel exactly exists in the biblical borders that God commanded Israel to live in. Yeah, I thought it was interesting, by the way, that this Hanukkah season, when the Jewish people celebrate the fact that that the Judeans, or the Jews, were successful in liberating themselves from the Syrian Greeks, that they proclaimed their independence under Judah Maccabee, the Hasmonean dynasty, the first in the Hasmonean dynasty. They lit the menorah, which lasted 8 days, and they were able to consecrate the temple and be independent again to create what's called the Second Commonwealth. The First Commonwealth, of course, was the Davidic Empire and the time of the Judges. And Palestinian intellectuals, I'm not sure who it was. I think it was someone at a Palestinian institution of learning in Judea and Samaria, they referred to this as Israel occupying Palestine. In other words, Judah Maccabee has successfully occupied Palestine. Well, I already got into the question of the term Palestine at the beginning of the segment, so I'm not going to rehash that. But what I'll say is, and I was thinking about that, I was actually talking about this with my teenage daughter. And the fact is that in using that sort of lingo, Israel has occupied Palestine, I think, 5 times since the beginning of human recorded history. The first time was when Abraham, the Aramean, our ancestor, heard God pointing him in the direction of the land that God would show him. You know, I don't have the exact quote in front of me here, but it was, go up from your father's house, leave idol worship, leave the cosmopolitan existence of Babylon, of Ur Kasdim, and go up and take possession of this tiny land. And Abraham did that. He and his family went up. They went to what actually the indigenous name for the land was Canaan, and they established the first sovereign Jewish state, or Israel state, Israelite state. I think Abraham was before the term Israel. The term Israel would only come into existence with Jacob, who took on the name Israel after his struggle with the angels. But he was to take possession of this land and create a holy people and to serve God. And Abraham did that. That was the first occupation, if you will. The second occupation was that when Jacob, who was also called Israel, went down to Egypt during the famine, settled his family in Egypt because his son Joseph had become prime minister. A generation or two later, they became slaves of the Egyptian Pharaoh. Of course, we know the story of how Moses led them out of slavery, crossed the Red Sea, accepted the Torah at Mount Sinai, wandered in the Sinai region for 40 years, eventually came to the land. Now, at that time, the borders of Israel are clearly delineated in the Torah, because 2.5 of the 10 tribes, of the 12 tribes, wanted to stay behind. They didn't want to go in the land. In other words, they didn't want to cross the Jordan River into the Holy Land. They wanted to stay on the east bank of the Jordan because they liked it there. But they also wanted their fellow Israelites to know that they were loyal to Israel. They were not trying to, it was not a civil war. And they proved that loyalty by agreeing that they would cross over with them and fight with them to create the Commonwealth. And then they would go back over the Jordan and live with their brethren west of, you know, in the East Bank. So when Moses died, having never entered the land, his successor, Joshua, as we know from the book of Joshua, crossed the Jordan, he conquered Jericho and proceeded to establish the Commonwealth of Israel. The Palestinian Arabs might call that the second occupation of Palestine. I mean, I guess using their lingo. That, of course, led to the period of judges, eventually the period of kings, the period of Solomon, where they reached the largest extent in terms of empire. And by the way, Solomon, we should note, had a very positive and a good relationship with Phoenicia, which was Canaan, or even you might even say they might have been the precursors to the Palestinians. They lived in what is today Lebanon on the coast. And that Hiram, the king of Tyre, one of the big cities there, actually assisted Solomon in the building of the temple and in the building of a modern navy and of developing a port at Eilat and of creating some of the modern administration of an empire. And so they actually had a friendly relationship. They traded with each other. They worked together. That was the, you might say, part of the Second Empire. Of course, after Solomon died, the empire divided into two squabbling sides, the Kingdom of Israel and the Kingdom of Judah. Israel was carried off into captivity by the Assyrians. And maybe about 100 years later, Judah lost its sovereignty and was carried off into captivity by the Babylonians. And so you had the exile. The exiled Jews living in Babylonia and maintaining their identity were to return when the Persians or the Medians under Cyrus the Great was able to subdue and conquer the Babylonians, and he issued an edict, which is republished in its entirety in the book of Ezra, commanding the Jews to go back to their homeland, reestablish their city of Jerusalem, reestablish their temple, and create a Jewish state. And by the way, at that point, they were using the word Jewish, or Judean, as it were. And so you had Ezra and his military lieutenant, Nehemiah, go back and reestablish Jewish sovereignty. You might say the Palestinians could say that was the third occupation of Palestine, I guess using their lingo. They were loyal to the Persian emperor, but they maintained and developed, you know, a sort of an autonomous region. And it was that region that was eventually conquered by Alexander the Great, who was friendly to the Jews and who recognized Judean autonomy. And then his Greek lieutenants, after he died, who took over and divided his empire. Israel would first be ruled by the Ptolemies out of Egypt and then by the Seleucids out of Syria. And that's where the Antiochus comes in. He was the Seleucid emperor. And he tried to destroy the Jewish people who were the majority there and who were indigenous to the region. He tried to take away temple worship. He replaced the temple with a statue of himself. He allowed for certain Greek practices like nude wrestling in the gymnasium, which was something that offended the sensibility of the Jews and of the rabbis, and other Greek practices. There was a rebellion. Judah Maccabee and his brothers and his father, Mattathiah, rebelled and fled to the mountains and fought a sort of, I guess you might say, a guerrilla war against the superior forces of the Greek-Syrian Empire that went on for several leaders until eventually under Simon, the youngest of the brothers, they were able to obtain full sovereignty. Judah made a deal, by the way, with the Romans at the time, who were emerging as the world power, and sent them a gift, and which some say was a mistake, of course, because it led to the eventual destruction of the Commonwealth. But either way, he was able to start the ball rolling, and the Commonwealth of Israel was reestablished, or what was called Judea, under the rule of the Hasmonean dynasty. And so you had the third occupation of Palestine by the Jews. Eventually, the Hasmonean dynasty would be gradually, step by step, taken over by the Romans, who dismantled it piece by piece by putting various Hasmonean puppets on the throne. Eventually, Herod went onto the throne. Herod had been an Idumean. His father had been forcibly converted to Judaism by John Hyrcanus, which was one of the great mistakes of Jewish history and one of the few times in Jewish history that a Jewish leader did try to forcibly convert people. And he was vengeful. He did maintain Jewish sovereignty under Roman tutelage, but nevertheless, he was very cruel. And it was a very difficult time for the Jewish people. He actually, his rule was the time that Jesus was born. And so eventually the Romans encroached further and further and further and eroded Jewish sovereignty until finally there was the rebellion, what's called the Jewish Wars by Josephus, the historian. And there were three or four years of complete sovereignty, which was followed by the utter destruction of the community by the Roman forces of Titus and the destruction of the Second Temple, which had been rebuilt by Ezra on the orders of Cyrus. And so Israel once again lost its sovereignty utterly. The Jewish people continued in the region. There was a second rebellion under Bar Kokhba about 100 years later. That was put down very brutally, and Hadrian renamed this state Palestine. But nevertheless, the Jewish presence continued. Many say there was a brief period of independence under the Byzantines. You might say, again, the Jews occupied Palestine before the ultimate takeover by Muslim forces and the gradual decline of the Jewish community, which, of course, never disappeared. There was always Jewish indigenous presence in the region. In fact, it's been said that Hebrew was the language of Jerusalem, even up to the time when the British arrived under General Allenby. There were always Zionist discussions. Napoleon talked about creating a Jewish state in Palestine during the period of which the French occupied Egypt in 1800. And he actually tried to invade in the Battle of Acre and was defeated. And who's here, Chris?
Yep.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Chuck.
Chris, what do you have coming here? Come on over. What do you have coming up? A four, thank you.
Yep.
So, yeah, there we go. Okay, I did it right.
No, that's phone.
That's a phone. So,
three.
Okay. There we go. Which one is it?
I think it's...
There we go. All right.
Okay.
Can I hear you? I can't. But one, two, three, four, and I'm up.
And go to three.
Go to three.
And go up.
Up and.
How about now?
There you go.
Okay, we got. 2 hours of freeform radio, kicking 2016 out with a blast.
Cool. What do you got? Anything particular? What are you listening to these days?
Anything and everything.
Anything and everything.
Yeah, we go from the 40s to the 2010s.
What? When you walked into the studio, did you have any particular tune that you wanted to hear?
No. what my listeners usually tell me what they want to hear. So.
So you swing open the phone lines and you get a call?
Exactly. Phone lines, Facebook, and let's see what else. Texts and
so people text you.
Yep.
So when you, I don't mean to put you in the spot. I just want to text because I'm completely inept on these matters, but. You have your Facebook page up.
Yep.
People text you and you read the text.
Yep.
And then you announce, and then you're able to go to, do you do it through?
I do it through Rivendale, my computer, the like 30 CDs I bring in, and sometimes I'll run out and find a record and play that.
So you really know how to do this, don't you?
I've been here since 2001.
Oh, okay. So you're a veteran.
Yep.
Community guy.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, do you, the show obviously streams live. Do you do a podcast?
No, I don't do a podcast. I'm not that technical yet.
See, that's where I actually do something. I don't know anything about the board, but just I'm actually able to go to the Spinatron, download the podcast,
yep.
Put it up on my Podomatic page, which then goes onto iTunes and Stitcher, and then I send it out on my blog site to my 25,000 social network friends.
Excellent. Well, so, sometimes I barely have enough time in the day just to do my show, so that's...
But you and I should collaborate sometime. Just you can show me how to run the board and
exactly.
Do all these wonderful things, and I could show you how to create podcasts and get out, get
Sounds
the show
good.
Out. All right, Chris.
Okay, so I'll be coming up soon, folks.
All right,
thanks, Chuck.
All right, so Chris is next. He'll be at the top of the hour. I'm just noticing that we're reaching the end of the hour, so I'm going to wind up my little history lesson here. And just point out that I think that I've illustrated what I think are the political and even you might say the spiritual motivation behind the Obama administration stab in the back of the state of Israel. I talked about how Israel represents what I would contend the Obama administration loathes and their people around them, and that is a sovereign, independent, democratic, capitalist society and a religious state that has a religious mission. I think I outlined what both of those are. So we'll leave that right there where it is. And I'm going to try to see if I can actually set up the board for Chris. So let me just part by pointing out that my books are available at Amazon.com. Just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, like Morse code. And you will see them come up. I've written over 10 books. I've got a new book. The manuscript is already finished. It's called The Age of Trump. That is not available yet. I have a literary agent who says that he says it's the best thing I've written, and he thinks it has commercial potential. So it's a very difficult business, but he is shopping it around to publishers, and hopefully it'll be published sometime soon, maybe within the next 3 months or so. If it's not published by that point, by mid-next year, I'll probably self-publish it. Most of my books are self-published. Some of them were published. The biggest book I wrote that was published by WND Press is called The Nazi Connection to Islamic Terrorism. All of my books are available at Amazon.com. You could check out my blog. You could check out my Facebook page, where this program will be archived as well. I'm actually recording it right now live on Facebook. And the podcast will appear in my Podomatic, iTunes, and Stitcher pages, as well as my blog site. So anyway, I want to thank everyone for listening this afternoon. Now, Chris, just I'm going to go to number five here to get Rivendell.
Yep, go hit pot.
Hit pot.
Pot, red,
right here.
It's hot. Rivendell's right there.
Rivendell's right here. Okay. And then wind this one down, and what do I click?
Okay, hold on a second.
Yep.
We'll go over here. We'll do a PSA.
Right.
So you come to...
Okay, and I did one earlier, so...
Okay, PSAs.
PSA,
and we'll
so let's...
find one that's for a minute.
A minute.
And say goodnight.
Good night, everybody. I shall return.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes. And you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger, two if you're very overweight, and three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm gonna keep ticking. But no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times? When we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while. Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change,